Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Vishnu Sahasranam, name 788, is Shubhanga. Fairly easy name to understand. Shubha means auspicious. Anga refers to limbs, so one whose limbs are all auspicious, beautiful. Who is beautiful, to put it simply? But specifically, the limbs of the body are very beautiful. This is also a fairly common name. Fairly common name in India, Shubhanga, Shubhangi for women. This name brings to mind the verse Shantakaram Bhujagashayanam Padmanabham Suresham. You know this verse, right? I think all the Brahmanas, at least in South India, they grow up knowing this. Yeah, there are any Chittahari is not here. I don't know where it's from, but it's a very well-known... Anyway, I'll finish the verse. Shantakaram Bhujagashayanam Padmanabham Suresham Vishvadharam Gaganasadrisham Meghavarnam Shubhangam Lakshmikantam Kamalanayanam Yogibhidhyanagamyam Vande Vishnum Bhavabhayaharam Saravalokaikanatham. When did you learn this verse, Atulananda? You didn't learn it. You did learn it. During a drama class. You were a Brahmana reciting it, is it? I see. We also find in the Gita Press edition of Bhagavad Gita, at least in Hindi, they have this verse quoted. Apart from Bhagavad Gita, they put a few other well-known verses, and this is one of them. Anyway, it's a description. It's in the form of offering obeisance to Lord Vishnu. It is invoking several of his names. Shantakaram, who is the form of peacefulness. Bhujagashayanam, who lies down on the serpent. Padmanabham. Where's Padmanabha? What does it mean? Padmanabha means a mischievous little boy. That's right. Krishna's a mischievous little boy. And by the way, there's a lotus growing out of his navel with the universe in it also. Suresham, that's a very common name in India. That's used, at least in North India, as a kind of, just like in English, you say every Tom, Dick and Harry. So you say, what do you say, Suresh, Ramesh, what's the other one? Rajesh, something like that. Is it? Something like that. Vishvadharam, who holds the whole universe. Gagana Sandrisham, who looks like the sky. Meghavarnam, the color of a cloud. Shubhangam, that's the name under discussion today. Lakshmi Kanta, the husband of Lakshmi. Kamalanayanam, lotus-eyed. Yogi Bir Dhyana Gamyam, who is aspired for in meditation by the yogis. Vande Vishnu, we offer obeisance to that Vishnu, who is Bhavabhaya Haram, who takes away the fear of material existence, and Sarvalokaikanatham, who is the Lord, the only Lord of all the worlds. So this name, Shubhangam, came up earlier in Vishnu Sahasranam, in Shlokam 63, in name 593, by the numbering system we're going by here. So, let's talk about it again. Shubha, auspicious, beautiful. Anga, a limb or a part of the body. And it also means a limb or a part of anything. We have, for instance, Sharavidha, Sharanagati. There's not right. Sharanga Sharanagati. Yeah, that's Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Says Sharanga Sharanagati. He refers to the six limbs of Sharanagati. Sharanga Sharanagati Hoibe Jaha Taha Pratana Shune Srinanda Kuma. Who has all the six limbs of Sharanagati? Nanda Kuma listens to their prayers. Got that? You have to fully surrender in all respects. Anukul yasya sankalpa. Do everything favorable. Reject everything unfavorable. Accept Krishna as our protector and our maintainer. Be very humble and throw ourselves at him. And then he'll listen to our prayers. The meaning that Parashara Bhatta gives to this name in this part of Vishnu Sahasranama, because he's talking about Buddhadev. He who has a bewildering form, mesmerizing form, bewitching form, that bewilders the asuras and misleads them. So referring to Buddhadev, as I was saying yesterday, it's very common in the homes of middle-class Hindus to have a statue of Buddha. And although Buddha didn't say to worship himself, it's an established part of Buddhism. That's probably why it's considered a religion. Well, there are many reasons why it's considered a religion. It has all the trappings of a religion. Everything's there except God. Sometimes Buddhists say it's not a religion, but it has all the cultural trappings of a religion and the emotional and sentimental trappings of a religion, but there's no God. But people do pray to Buddha, and the form of Buddha was very attractive. Vishnu is very attractive. So the very form of Buddha that also attracted people to him, because people are attracted to the various opulences, aren't they? Aishvaryasya, Samagrasya, Viryasya, Yashasya, Shriyaha. Shriyaha means beauty. And it's a natural tendency of everyone to like to see beautiful people. In the advertisements, they show beautiful people, unless they're selling benefits, something beneficial for old people. How to take this pill and you'll be feeling healthy in old age. But generally they sell things showing pictures of young people and beautiful people. And it is a tendency also that we tend to trust people who are good looking. There's no particular reason why we should do. But that tendency is there. That's been noted. The psychologists, sociologists, I guess one of the, they have noted in America, where they study all kinds of things like this, all kinds of psychological and sociological phenomena, that the women in general in courts, they tend to we hear about the disparity, the pay disparity between men and women, but we don't hear about how they tend to get judged more leniently than men for the same crimes. And if they're found guilty, they get punished more leniently also, and especially if they're a beautiful woman. And we tend to trust them. Do you find any ugly politicians? Hardly. In the Western world especially, if you're really ugly and you have to look presentable, look like you're doing well. So that's essential. You have to be able to talk and you have to look good and look healthy and all these things. Because people tend to trust those who are good looking. It's a great mistake. In fact, Srila Prabhupada used to quote from Chanakya, what is that? Rupavati Nari. What is that? Rupavati Bharya Shatru. It's not exactly, it's something like that. Anyway, the meaning is that if one's wife is beautiful, she's an enemy. And he explained that in various ways, that one thing is that other men will want to steal her away. And another thing is that one can become so bewildered by the beauty that one forgets the real goal of life. Having heard that, no one's going to try and find out an ugly wife. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the ugliest of them all? It's considered even... Mukunda Maharaj wrote in his autobiographical work about... Well, it was biographical about Srila Prabhupada, but necessarily it was autobiographical about himself. So he mentioned in there that it was called Miracle on Second Avenue, the book. So he mentioned there that he felt good about himself, that he had, he was a well-established jazz musician and people came to him and for recording and this and that, and he had a good-looking wife. He felt pretty good about it. So that is one of these... The opulences, right? Shriyaha. One of the six opulences, to be beautiful yourself and to have a beautiful wife. And it's... Then people tend to think you're better. And of course, in the case of Vishnu, that is true. He's very beautiful and he has a very beautiful wife. She's not his enemy. She's the friend of everyone. But in the case of Buddhadev, his beauty also enhanced his bewildering facet. His teaching is bewildering. Why on earth anyone would want to go through so much difficulty just to become nothing is... amazing. And they don't even believe that he teaches that everything in this world is miserable, which of course is nothing original. It's been miserable ever since the creation, and people have noticed it, not only him. But he taught that you have to go through all these difficulties to get free from that. But then... what do you get? You get some indescribable. We also say the bliss of Vaikuntha is indescribable, but they just say it's indescribable. There's no bliss. At least in the impersonal Brahman, there's some idea of Brahma Sukh, spiritual happiness. But in Nirvana, there's no happiness. There's no anything. There's not even nothingness. It's not nothing. It's neither nothing nor absence of nothing. Don't ask me to explain. Don't ask anyone to explain. It's unexplainable. It's the void. But he attracted them to that. And the moral life. Buddhism prescribes a moral life. Okay. I guess it's attractive. They don't follow it, but ahimsa paramo dharma. Actually, my Buddhists, they do follow it. It's just like I was speaking about Thailand. They don't kill animals willingly, a real Buddhist. But they, as I was saying, they don't like the Muslims, but the Muslims have an important role in Thai society. They're the butchers. So you don't kill the animals yourself, the Muslims kill them. And you condemn them for being violent, and then you buy the meat from them. A lot of hypocrisy there. Another meaning of the name, given by Parashara Bhakta, is Yogi Bir. It fits with Yogi Bir Dhyana Gamyam. His auspicious form is meditated upon by his true devotees. So the form of Buddha is attractive, but the form of Vishnu is even more attractive. We shouldn't think that because Buddha is attractive and misleading people. Mohini Murti also, by her attractive form, and then the demons thought, oh, woman, she beautiful woman, she won't cheat us. We can trust her. It's a great mistake to trust a beautiful woman. Does that mean every beautiful woman is untrustworthy? But in this case, when you don't know where she's from, who she is, she's not protected by anyone, she's acting independently, and you trust her. It makes no sense whatsoever. But the demons trusted her because they thought, she must be nice. She talks so nicely. Be very careful when people talk very nicely to you, especially if you don't know them. If you know them and you know about their character and they're speaking nicely, that's very good. That Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that's one of the speaking sweetly, right? That's a quality and the mode of goodness. But if someone comes up to you and speaks very nicely, then you think, oh, you don't know them. Not necessarily they're out to cheat you, but good chance. Good chance. The same with advertisements. They promise you so many things. There's this, you get that, you get this, and it only costs you so much money. They're not interested in the people who are selling you something. They're not interested in what good they can do for you. They're interested in, all you have to do to get this is give us your money. That's what they're interested in. There are any number of jokes following this line. you're offering so many good things. Okay, what's the catch? And then, shall I tell some jokes? Maybe not in class. I'll tell you afterwards. Anyway, you know so many jokes. Jokes help us to get through life. Otherwise, you're going to... There's a saying in English, it's probably in every language. You can either laugh or you can cry. Things are so mad and so frustrating. You can laugh or you can cry, but you can't change it. It's just life goes on. We were talking about management. Everything looks very good. It looks very good because at every moment you have to supervise people so they don't do the same stupid thing they've been doing for every day for the last 20 years, and every day you've been telling them not to do it. That's called management. There you go. You can laugh or you can cry. Sometimes most of the time we cry, but from time to time we just laugh. Actually, Srila Prabhupada in Vrindavan in 1975, after opening the temple, he was trying to get the devotees to organize things, and he couldn't even get them to organize the bell being rung every hour, and so many other little things. The flower sellers were cheating the devotees because they'd have the weighing scale, and show it so much weight of flowers. And the devotees don't realize that underneath the flowers there are some stones. It's a normal thing in India in those days. And that's why they always give you a little extra at the end, right? Just to show. And I'm cheating you, but I'm giving you a little back to pretend I'm not cheating you. Something like that. Remember that? Even in Bombay they used to do it. Yeah, of course. Everywhere they used to do it. Where they used to sell loose atta. You can hardly get it now, probably. Is it? I don't know. Loose everything, sugar, salt. And the shopkeeper will talk to you very nicely. It's just like Srila Prabhupada quotes in that Bhagavad Gita purport. He says the shop in that, what is that? Sahajang karma kontaya. What is that? Sadosha mapinatyajat. Every kind of work there's some fault, but you don't leave the work because there's some fault in it. And Srila Prabhupada gave the example that the merchant tells you, for you I'm making no profit. But you know he's lying, because if he doesn't make a profit, then how? What's the point? How can he live? Is it? You're looking up the verse? No. Okay. Anyway, you don't know it, so even if I quote it wrong, you don't know. Savadaman parityajya kumarang yovanang tata brahmayan sarvabhutani. What's the meaning of this verse? Oh, no, so many verses. Oh, my God. So everything, the Buddha, by his all his angas, everything about him was deceitful. If you take anga to mean the limbs, and it can mean everything about him, all different parts, his speech, the way he walks, the way he talks, the way he dresses, everything about him is deceitful. Sadhu dress also. People tend to trust Buddha dressed as a sadhu. And acting like a sadhu and speaking of philosophy, which sounds very good, sadhu. Yeah. Don't lie, don't steal, be of good conduct, follow the dharma. He was using the word dharma. So it all looks very good until you get to the end, and then you find the end is, where is the end? What is the ultimate goal in Buddhism? There is no ultimate goal. Actually, if you try to logically unpack it, there's no difference between nirvana and samsara, which is not, because neither of them exist. So then again, you go back to samsara. Yeah, it's all aimed at, we know in Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says that Ashadadhana Purusha Dharmasyasya Parantapa Aprapya Mangnevartante Mrityu Sangsara Vartmani. Those who are not faithful on the path of devotional service do not attain me but return to repeated birth and death. So Buddha Dev was preaching in such a way to make people not faithful in the path of Dharma, to reinterpret dharma. It's very misleading because he gave all the basic behavior of dharma, good conduct, good, right conduct, right speech, and all the basic parts of. But then he, instead of the dharma supposed to lead toward Vishnu, surrender to Vishnu, the Supreme Person, he makes it into his idea of nirvana. So it's very misleading. Sadhus can be very misleading. It's amazing why people in India still have so much faith in sadhus when so many of them are bogus. But many of them get away with it throughout their life being bogus. And even if they're exposed as being maha-bogus, as in the case of Osho, for instance. Actually, he had the name Rajneesh, and he got such a bad reputation, he changed his name to Osho and tried to remake his profile. And at the time, people in America didn't like him at all, the great majority of people. And in India, people didn't like him at all, especially in Pune, where he had his ashram. They didn't like him at any time, but they especially didn't like him after he was... There's so much exposure of his rampantly anti-religious activities. But now he's considered, like, yeah, a very good very good sadhu, and people watch his YouTube videos, which they didn't have YouTube at the time, but people made videos. And it used to be, before Sadhguru came up, that you go to people's houses, and if they think they're somewhat spiritual, they'd have Osho books. There was a period, right? You remember going on book distribution? And it was the fashionable thing. So it's amazing. You can do it. Look at this rascal from Tiruvannamalai, the latest rascal, that Paramahamsa Nityananda, totally exposed as being not only bogus, but amazingly stupid. Even by most of the bogus sadhus, they're not stupid. I wouldn't say Sadhguru's stupid. He's an intelligent guy, no doubt. I've watched about 3 minutes of one of his videos, and it's enough to know that he's not, materially speaking, stupid. But this Paramahamsa Nityananda, he's amazingly, it's just, if you can say he's transcendental, he's beyond this world, yeah, he's in stupidity, he's breaking new barriers. But still he still has a following. Gullibility. The gullibility of Indians to accept people as holy, even when they're not holy, is actually a great obstacle in preaching Krishna consciousness. It's an advantage in one sense, preaching in India, that people tend to respect us because we're dressed as sadhus, but then it's also a disadvantage because they respect so many other people who are dressed as sadhus and they don't know the difference. As the saying goes, don't get into an argument with a fool, because other people won't be able to tell the difference. They'll just take, he's a fool, you're a fool, and it don't go down to their level. Because most people are foolish. They can't differentiate. They can't see. So Buddhadev, he was misleading people in the dress of a sadhu. But then it's considered, no, he was something very good. Buddhism. Neutral scholars of comparative religion, they often think, well, yeah, Buddhism is a very good religion. If everyone became a Buddhist, that would be very good, because all other religions, they're very contentious. But actually, it doesn't work. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, "Vinashayata dushkritam." It's just realistic. There'll always be bad people, and you have to have kshatriyas to control and, if necessary, kill the bad elements. That's not the first expedient, but if they are incorrigible and very bad, you may have to kill them. So it's all very well to be Buddhism, be peaceful and this and that, but although Buddhadev was himself from Kshatriya background, he was warned when he was preaching by the local kings, "You don't recruit any of our Kshatriyas, otherwise we won't have anyone to protect you and your followers." They all become, so he left the Kshatriyas alone. And later, there's no clear understanding of how Buddhism vanished from India. One of the factors is Muslim destruction of Nalanda and other places. Another factor is that Mahayana Buddhism became prominent, which is worship of Buddha and all kind of imaginary Buddhas, and it merged into Hinduism when all the leaders were killed by the Muslims. But another reason that the Buddhists themselves here in India talk about is that persecution by Hindu kings. Because the Hindu kings didn't like it. They wanted to restore Hinduism because it upheld the caste system by which they could organize society. And Buddhism was against the caste system, and particularly was against Brahmanas and Kshatriyas, because Brahmanas they considered to be misleading people. Even in Burma, they have a hard time preaching Krishna consciousness because they have this thing that Brahmanas, they're the bad people. Because that was from the beginning, Buddha was preaching against the Brahmanas performing yajnas. And who else is performing the yajna? The Kshatriyas. The Brahmanas are the yajniks, the ones doing the yajna, and the Kshatriyas are the yajaman, the one who commissioned the yajna for the big yajnas. And at home, the Kshatriyas would also do their... But all the animal-killing yajnas are generally performed by Brahmanas and commissioned by Kshatriyas. So they're very much against Brahmanas and Kshatriyas. So the Hindu kings thought this Buddhism. It's seditious. It undoes the whole structure of the state. So the Hindus also some Hindu kings persecuted Buddhists at some point. It's a long and complex history because, of course, Buddhism got a big boost when Ashoka the Great promoted it, a king promoted it. But he's only able to promote it after he conquered much of India, and then he didn't have any rival kings left. Because if he promoted Buddhism and became very peaceful while the rival kings were there, they'd just come in and wipe him out. It only works if everyone in the world is a Buddhist. It's like they say, Islam is the religion of peace. Then we'll kill everyone else, and when the whole world is Islamic, then it'll be peaceful. Of course, we still have to sort out the Sunni-Shia problem, and then the Ahmadiyyas and the Aga Khanis and all that kind of thing. So, but it's the religion of peace, but it's very theoretical. That's Krishna, what he gives in Bhagavad Gita with Varnashram is very practical. That there are people at different levels, materially, spiritually, and what we is nowadays goes by the name of Hinduism, but Vedic culture, it deals with all different kinds of people. That's why we were discussing yesterday. You can't force all the grihasthas to live like ultra brahmacharis. There's a grihastha ashram and there's a brahmachari ashram. You can't make the grihasthas like super austere. Some of them may be like that. They might be like that. And the brahmana rishis in the forest, they would be like that. But you just can't force it on people. There's a difference. The difference in how people live their lives, and the main thing is that everyone has to chant Hare Krishna and serve Krishna according to their present position. It's not just like everyone has to be exactly the same in all respects. That's a great strength, actually, of Varnashram culture. And if this could be discussed more broadly within our ISKCON society, where there's all this tension between those who want to be strict and those who don't want to be very strict. Actually, there's not that much tension because hardly anyone wants to be strict. But it can be resolved by Varnashram. Those who want to be very strict, they're Brahmanas. Others, you be in other Varnas. Still, you have to accept some rules. Everyone has to accept some rules. If you don't accept any rules, then you're just a chandala. That's all. You can still chant Hare Krishna, but you're not within the Varnashram system. So, getting off the point here. Actually, these are very important points, but not exactly for the Shubhanga discussion. So, another meaning is this word Anga we find in Ashtanga Yoga. Right? Ashtanga Yoga. What is that? Yama, Niyama, Asana, Pranayama, Dharana, Dhyana. Pranayama, Pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, samadhi, the eight angas or the eight parts of the yoga system which leads to the samadhi, the ultimate aim. So Shubhanga means he who makes the Ashtanga yoga, he brings it to fruition. It's possible to become successful. What's the fruition? Dhyana vastita tadgatena manasa pasyanti yam yoginaha, which also comes in one name here, which we just read, yogibhir dhyana gamyam. The yogis, ultimately, they have to meditate upon Vishnu. So he who makes it possible to become successful in the yoga, Ashtanga yoga system. So that's another meaning of the word Shubhanga. That's one of the meanings that Shankaracharya gives in his commentary on Vishnu Sahasranam, that he's worshipped by his devotees and ultimately he's worshipped by the yogis. And if the yogis, for all their rigid austerities, they can become attracted to the beautiful form of Vishnu, then their Ashtanga yoga is perfect. But if one becomes attracted by the beautiful form of Buddha and on that account follows his teachings, then you're in a lot of trouble. We have some devotees here from Nepal, which is a Hindu cum Buddhist country. Hinduism there is very much mixed up with Buddhism. Maybe not, you're from the Terai, is it? Yeah. I can't hear. In the Terai, it's more like India, but when you get up in the mountains, the Hinduism is very much mixed up with Buddhism, and more so since so many Tibetans came in. So it's just like you see the Hindus in Sindh and Punjab, they worship the Sikh gurus because they're around there. So they worship them also, along with the Hindu gods. And in Bengal, they often worship the Hindus worship the Muslim peers also, because they're someone holy. Here in Tamil Nadu, they have Our Lady of Velankani, and the Hindus go also. Anyone to worship, you worship them. We don't have any discrimination, it's all one. So where there's an influence of Buddhism, the Hinduism becomes mixed up with Buddhism also. It's a very syncretic kind of religion. Everything fits in. Everything fits into it. You want to do yoga? You can do yoga. Meditate. Take a long time. Many lifetimes, and otherwise you can chant Hare Krishna and get the same result much more easily and without so much difficulty. So you might as well chant Hare Krishna and go to Krishna without going through so much difficulty. Regarding the beautiful form of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one of the commentators here, Radha Krishna Shastri, refers to the beginning of Ramayana when Valmiki asked Narada about who is there in the world now who is Gunavan, Viryavan, Dharmagya, Kritagya, Satyavakya, and Dhiravrata. Who is there in the world now who is full with all qualities, who's very powerful, who knows what is dharma, who is very grateful, has the quality of gratefulness, who speaks truthfully and is firmly fixed in his vow? So these are all different angas. The answer is from the beginning of Ramayana, so you can understand. The answer is Lord Sri Rama. So he has all these facets of his personality, all these angas. And also, Narada describes the beauty of Rama's form. Vipulangsho, huge. Vipulangsho Mahabahu Kambu Grivo Mahahanuhu Mahorasko Maheshvaso Gurha Jatra Arindamaha Ajanubahu Sushira Sulalata Suvikramaha Sama Sama Vibhaktanga Snigdavarna Pratapavan Pina Vaksha Vishalaksho Lakshmivan Shubhalakshanaha Shubhalakshana Shubhanga Shubhalakshana, he has auspicious characteristics. Shubhanga, his, all the parts of him are auspicious. So Ram has broad shoulders, long arms, a beautiful neck, a beautiful face, broad chest. Maheshvasa, he's an expert archer. That word comes in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita also. A very strongly built body. He can subdue his enemies with ease. Again, about his arms, they reach to his knees. A beautiful head and forehead. Beautiful gait. They didn't give the whole translation. I better do it myself. Suvik, beautiful gait. All his bodily parts are well balanced. He has a very beautiful bodily complexion. He is very beautiful, has broad eyes. He is the abode of all opulence, and everything about him is auspicious. In his commentary on this verse, Sri Radha Krishna Shastri also quotes from Hanuman, who describes to Sita, famously in Sundara Kanda, the beauty of Lord Rama, by which she becomes convinced that Hanuman is not a deceitful emissary of Ravana, because no one could speak so nicely about Rama unless he was a devotee. But the name Sundara is coming up just after three names, so I'll leave that for then. Sundara is very similar. Sundara, you all know, means beautiful. Going back and forward here. Mohini Murti, she was so beautiful that even Lakshmi felt. What's going on? I'm supposed to be the most beautiful. Who's this? I can't help feeling attracted. Even Lakshmi felt shy. Satyadeva Vashishta, as usual, gives a completely different kind of interpretation by breaking up the Sanskrit and analyzing it in a different way. He has a beautiful gait, G-A-I-T. He walks very nicely. The way he moves, that was discussed in recently in my series of talks in the name Chaturgati, four kinds of walking that described that Ram walks in four ways, like, I can't remember, a lion, an elephant, a bull, and I think maybe the fourth was a ram, I don't know. Another meaning, he pervades everywhere at all times with his auspicious form. So his shubhanga, the parts of himself, well, everything's a part of himself because everything is related with him and he's auspicious. So if we can see him everywhere, we can see auspiciousness everywhere. And Satyadeva Vashishta, he often gives names of Vishnu, interprets them in the sense of how Lord Vishnu pervades this world, maintains this world, upholds this world, is active in this world, and he gives the meaning of the name Shubhanga in this way. He makes everything, all the parts of this universe, functional in a beautiful way. Everything fits together in a very beautiful way, and there's so much beauty in nature. And this name sums up all that Satyadeva Varshishta says about how Lord Vishnu operates within this universe. Baladev Vidyabhushan gives a completely different meaning to any of the other commentators, that the prominent commentators, that he brings about, he interprets the word anga as angayati in a completely different sense, that he means to bring about. He brings about auspiciousness in the form of confidence in himself and in the words of the spiritual master and the scriptures. So one who is endued with faith that Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, Bhagawan, these are all giving the truth. I can surrender to Krishna. I can have faith in this. I can do this. One who has this faith can very easily make progress on the path of going to Krishna. So Krishna within the heart helps us to have strong faith if we want to. Just like he says, tasya tasyaj, about the demigods. I make the demigod worshippers' faith in the demigods strong. Yo yo yang yang tanung bhakta shadhayacharam ichati tasya tasyachalang shadham tameva vedatami aham. One who wants to worship the demigods, I make their faith in the demigods very strong. So why will he not make faith in himself and in the Shastra and in the sadhus strong also? Those who want to approach him, he will help them in that way. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Shubhanga Bhagavan ki jai. Vancha kalpa tarupyascha kripa sindhubhyo eva cha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo. Namo namaha. Dante nithaya churna kang padaya nepatya. Kritva cha kaku shatame tadaham bravimi. Hey sadhava sakala eva vihaya durat. Gauranga chandra charane kurutanuraga. Parivadatu jano yata tata va nanu makaro navayang vichara yamaha. Hari rasa madirama dati matta. Bhuvi vilo pama natama nirvishama. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare.